Good morning. Welcome to the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Today is Thursday, February 26th. We are going to wait until next week to approve the minutes, and we will approve two sets of minutes. And so we do have a quorum. I'm going to read the safety notice as we've been instructed to do for every committee. To ensure everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort for all attendees, please note the following guidelines. Signs are not prohibited in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. Standing or sitting in walkways and aisles is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak to the sergeant staff, and they have gold ties on. State troopers and House security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it, as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct this hearing efficiently, while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. The first bill we have before us this morning, members, is House File 3676. Welcome, Chair Nash, to this Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. And what we'd like to do first is, first of all, I'll move your bill. And the request is that it be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance and Policy. So we'd like you to explain the bill, and then I believe you have an A3. We're going to discuss that amongst our, amongst the committee members, and because we have three amendments that have been submitted. Some of them are somewhat overlapping, so we want to get to the bottom of what the best remedy is here. As far as what we add to the bill. So with that, Chair Nash, go ahead and explain the bill, what it does. Your testifiers can go ahead and explain. I understand they're from the Safe at Home program, and we're all somewhat familiar with that. So go ahead, and then we'll cover your, after the bill explanation, we'll cover the A3.
Very good. Thank you, Chair Scott, Chair Liebling, for having me in today. 3676 is a bill that came out of a chance meeting with my favorite banker in the world, my wife. Was doing her job, and a constituent of mine was sitting at her desk and actually began breaking down crying because of a situation that she found herself in. And I cannot share her name, nor will I, the constituent, but she was a battered woman from California who fled here. And through a series of giant cataclysmic mistakes, the Department of Health and the Department of Youth, Family, and Children exposed her previous name to credit agencies and others under and assigned it with her new assumed name with the address here in Minnesota. My wife told me, which she oftentimes does, and I've given her permission. She said, well, here is a number that I want you to call. This is my husband. He's a state legislator. He'll see if he can get this fixed. So I got a call from the constituent and shared her story with me. And through working with House GOP Constituent Services and the Secretary of State's office, we addressed her issue very quickly, but realized that there are a lot of, I'll call them deficiencies that exist in the Safe at Home law that would even allow for some of these things to happen. And I know for those of us that have been here for a while or those that work in the courts, you understand what the Safe at Home program is, so I won't go through explaining it, but from my take, when you enter the Safe at Home program, you should become invisible at your request, and that is super important to this constituent. I don't know how many hours I spent on the phone listening to this person just living in fear over the phone with me as to what was going on. So we have some fixes here today that will address not just the issue that I'm bringing because of my constituent, but then another one that popped into my mind and then some others that came from the Secretary of State. So the first one that I'll share that I brought is, if you remember, I think all members were here last year, my story as an abused kid I became an emancipated minor at 17, and I asked the Secretary's staff, would I have been able to, if I lived in Minnesota, become a participant in the Safe at Home program as an emancipated minor? And the answer was no. So here's our fix. So in my example, as an abused kid, if I felt like I needed to go into the Safe at Home program and effectively disappear, I would not have been able to. With passage of 3676 eventually, that would become something that would be a possibility. So to the balance of the other changes, the Secretary of State's office is with us today, and I've asked them if they would walk through some of them just so that they, as the administrators of the program, can walk us through with specificity to do that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Nash. And I'm not sure which one of your testifiers is going to go first. Okay, go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chair Scott. Nicole Freeman from the Office of the Secretary of State. I serve as the Government Relations Director, and I'm joined at the table by Diana Umadon, our Director of the Safe at Home Services. I'm going to do a really quick walkthrough of the sections, of each section of the bill, and then Diana is going to add a little bit more depth to an explanation to a few of the provisions. So starting off with Section 1, we're modifying a few definitions. As Co-Chair Nash just mentioned, one of those is adding emancipated minor as someone who could apply as an applicant, someone who would be eligible to apply as an applicant. This Section 1 also defines over the requirement for a guardian, and who would be considered a guardian and who can apply on behalf of an eligible minor. We want to make it clear that right now it's not defined in statute what type of guardian. As you know, there's a number of different guardianship situations, and so we're looking to make it clear and easy for our staff and for potential participants to understand. This section also seeks to adjust the definition of program participant for banking purposes. This is a piece that we are working with the Bankers Association on, and I think we anticipate it will be modified or come out in the next committee stop. So I'll just kind of move quickly through that part. Section 2 clarifies that a guardian who is applying on behalf of a minor, that they need to provide a copy of the court order that is establishing guardianship or legal custody when they submit that their application on behalf of an eligible minor. We want to make sure that, you know, this is a person who can apply. And that also we take a look at the expiration date of that guardianship agreement to make sure that we just that we understand the situation as they're going in. Section 3 clarifies a bank's obligation, and we were looking to require them to accept a Safe at Home street address for business accounts. Again, that's something we're working with the Bankers Association on, and I think for right now it will be coming out, but we'll continue to work with them on that. Section 4 requires a judge to make an explicit finding that potential harm to the safety of the participant is outweighed by the interest in disclosing a Safe at Home participant's address. We are interested in that finding coming in writing, and also when that finding is made, that our office is notified and that there's a time period. We're very willing to work with the courts and have reached out to get their feedback on this section, but feel like it's important to make sure that both the participant has time to prepare for that disclosure if it does need to happen, and also ensure that the judge has walked through the findings in Chapter 5B and takes those steps. So that's there. In Section 5, we are seeking to align the penalty for disclosure of a Safe at Home participant's data. If that disclosure causes bodily harm, we'll align that penalty, making it a felony. And that penalty matches the Judicial Data Protection Act, and the penalties included in there. In Section 6, we're seeking to prohibit discrimination of a participant based on their status as a Safe at Home participant. And we modeled this after other anti-discrimination laws throughout statute and are still working on that section as well. Section 7 would require Minnesota government offices to designate a safe at home point person, essentially. It's our recommendation that really most directly relates to the constituent issue that we worked with Representative Nash on this fall. And our hope is that, you know, this will allow our office to respond more quickly to participant issues as they arise and get to the right person within a government office. Sections 8 and 9 allow a participant to use the Safe at Home card as a proof of residence by adding that Safe at Home participation card as an acceptable proof of residence, not proof of identity, but proof of residence for obtaining a state driver's license, ID, or Minnesota real ID. Section 10, I know, is there's an amendment related to this. It would require judges to receive training on the Safe at Home program. The goal with that was that to ensure that judges are understanding what a participant's obligations are and what the disclosure of that data might, how that disclosure might impact a participant. And then sections 11 and 12 are in the A3 amendment to come out. And this would require police officers to receive training on Safe at Home. Currently, we're invited to a number of trainings with law enforcement officers and have really appreciated that partnership. And so we're going to continue to work with them on that requirement in the future. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Next, we have Ms. Humadon. Go ahead.
Hello. My name is Diana. Thank you, Chair Scott. My name is Diana Humadon. I'm the director for Safe at Home. And I thank you for allowing me to speak briefly. And I do want to thank Representative Nash for his interest in making Safe at Home even stronger and sponsoring this bill. Currently, for statistics reasons, so you know, we have approximately 5,400 active Safe at Home participants. That number increases daily. Every year we do see a growth, and that's about 2,500 households right now. I did want to speak to just a couple of pieces of this bill. Nicole explained, you know, yes, we do want to define guardian, and that is strictly for initial enrollment purposes. It has always been our practice that if a child does have a guardian, that we do collect a copy that they do show that they have court-appointed guardianship of that child in order for enrollment purposes. Now, it could be a situation where there is a DOPA, delegation of parental authority, and that is acceptable after enrollment, that's fine. That person that has a DOPA, delegation of parental authority, we will work with them, for example, to transfer student records. But for the initial enrollment, we feel, and we've always practiced this, so this would just be formalizing what we've always done, that it does have to be a court-appointed guardian or parent that does enroll that child in Safe at Home. Enrolling in an address confidentiality program is a very big safety step. Around the time of enrollment, there's relocation to a confidential address. There's safety planning that needs to occur. There's a lot of safety threats that are occurring. That decision, we feel, should be made by someone who is the parent or court-appointed guardian. So we're just clarifying what we've already been practicing. The other thing that I wanted to speak to is the piece about contacts with other state offices. This is something that we run into quite a bit. When a participant calls our office and presents a problem to us that involves another state office, we often have to do the legwork, go online, look at an organizational chart, try to figure out who it is that we contact at that other state office to address this problem. It often involves a participant who owns real property. And to give you an example of a few things that we have to, that we have worked with other state offices before on our radon testing, well disclosures, community land trusts, electronic visit verification, driveway permits, spraying for weeds. So these are all things that we have had to connect with other offices on, and the list would continue. It would be very beneficial to have those offices have a designated person for us so that we know who to reach out to point us in the right direction. Thank you very much.
I'm not a net new employee. I'll address that part.
Thank you to the testifiers. Representative Nash, did you want to say something?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Just on that last point, to have a point of contact within each agency and department, those would be people that already exist and work in those agencies. It would just be somebody who would probably volunteer to come forward and serve in that role. Just wanted to clarify that, so we're not asking for a new employee to be hired or placed in that. So.
Thank you for that. Are there any members of the public that wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Nash, let's go to your A3.
Madam Chair, with your indulgence, we are effectively willing to take all of these amendments and might actually defer to House Nonpartisan to sift through which accomplishes each, or
okay.
We'd be willing to take all three of them in one fell swoop. I leave it to your discretion.
Helpful or not? Well, why don't you explain the A3?
Sure.
And what it does.
Yep.
And then let's have some member discussion on that.
Yep. I'll have my testifier do that one.
Perfect. All right, Ms. Freeman, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Scott. So the A3 amendment on lines 1.2 and 1.3, here we're looking to add in the sections that relate to allowing a safe at home participant card be a valid proof of residence. We're looking to add just a clarification that a participant can't use a temporary card for this purpose. So you might remember a few years ago, we allowed folks who are moving to Minnesota within the next 60 days to be able to enroll in Safe at Home and take advantage of those safety protections as they're in the process of moving. When they're in that pre-status of moving to Minnesota, they receive a temporary card. That temporary card doesn't say they're a resident of Minnesota yet, right? It says they're going to move to Minnesota. And so we just wanted to clarify that it wouldn't be appropriate for them to use their temporary card. Once they move to Minnesota, as soon as they reach out to the office, they're issued a regular safe at home card. But just because we do have folks that are taking advantage of the program so they can safely move and relocate to Minnesota, we wanted to just make that clarification. So that's lines 1.2 and 1.3. And then lines 1.4 and 1.5 delete sections 11 and 12. And my understanding is we're just going to continue working with police officers moving forward in the future on those two sections. So, yeah.
Is there member discussion? Representative Mueller, Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash, for bringing this bill. I appreciate this amendment, and we talked about the deleting Section 11 and 12 because I know law enforcement talked to us about the training they have and the need for training dollars and not wanting to add in more training without dollars attached to it. So I haven't heard from them about that, but I assume that they would have brought that up to us if they had known about it. So I'm glad that you're taking it out and can continue to work with them and train them anyway without the requirement in statute. Thanks.
Any other member discussion on this amendment? Representative Nash, it seems to me that if we adopt the A3, the A1 is no longer necessary. And then we can probably take up the A2 separately if it's the author of that amendment intends to still take that amendment up. So without further objection, I think what we'll do is we'll take up the A3 and take a vote on that. Members, the A3 is before us. The A3 to the I recommend that the A3 to House File 3676 be adopted. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. The A2, Co-Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would move the A2 just for discussion purposes here. And So this would strike the section that requires judges to have training. And the reason I have this drafted is just that often we know on this committee the judiciary doesn't really like us to mandate them to do things. And I'm looking, but when you look at the section that it's in here, it's already mandating them to do a lot of training. I haven't actually heard any objection from the judiciary, and I don't know if there's anyone in the room here who, or, and you're shaking your head, Representative Nash, I don't think you've heard anything either. So if no one is here from the judiciary, and I'm not hearing any objections.
Sneak it in.
So unless anyone else wants to speak to it, my intention would be to withdraw it. So I'm going to withdraw the amendment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Liebling. And so do we officially need to withdraw the A1? Have somebody withdraw that?
Just wasn't offered.
Nobody offered it. Okay. No. So the bill is before us as amended. Any other committee comments, committee member comments? Seeing none, Chair Nash. Final words.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just appreciate the thoughtful discussion and the proactive help from many of my colleagues. This is something that I think many in this room have worked on. I believe, Chair Scott, you've done things at the Safe and Home program. Chair Liebling, I think you've done some work in it in the past. This is a really good program, and I don't believe every state has them, and they really should. And on behalf of the constituent who will remain nameless, this is a step in the right direction to make sure that what happened to them does not happen by accident or error again, and we're able to tighten this up. So thank you so much for your consideration.
Thank you, Chair Nash, for bringing this bill and to your testifiers today and all the work they do within the Safe at Home program. It's a really wonderful program. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3673 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance and Policy. All those in favor, please signify. Oop, what was
3676.
What did I say? Mm-hmm. 3676 yeah. Is the correct bill number. Not
as
sure
amended.
What I said. As amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance and Policy. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is adopted as amended.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Next, we will hear from Chair Scott presenting House File 2959. The intention is to lay this bill over today. Chair Scott, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, House File 2959 makes Minnesota's property tax system fair and more transparent by protecting taxpayers' confidential business data, while ensuring the courts and assessors have access to the information needed to determine accurate property values. The bill answers the Supreme Court's invitation to clarify the law, strengthens due process protections, and fosters trust in the property tax appeals process. House File 2959 responds to the Minnesota Supreme Court's GNI 9 OIC LLC versus County of Hennepin decision by tightening the handling of income property assessment, which is also known as IPA data, in property tax proceedings. Under current law, the government can unilaterally make non-public data public simply by introducing it at trial with no notice to the taxpayer. County assessors also use sensitive business information, which, and I would direct members to the first paragraph of House Research's summary that talks about, in that first line of the second paragraph, just that this is a very sensitive business data. So county assessors also use sensitive business data information from other properties to justify assessments, meaning that the secret recipe that gives a business its competitive edge could be exposed. The Supreme Court noted that there is tension between accurate property assessments, data privacy, and due process, and suggested the legislature could clarify the rules. They also have other language smattered throughout that opinion of that court case that say things like striking a different balance. Or the court said that section 27805, subdivision 3, is ambiguous. So they're asking us for clarification. House File 2959 closes the loophole and follows the court's suggestion by ensuring transparency in litigation while protecting taxpayers' confidential information and preserving due process. With that, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Testifier, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Name is Lane Thor. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sir Co-Chair, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Lane Thor. I've been a Minnesota property tax professional for nearly 20 years, both as a former assessor and currently as a consultant. Currently, I serve as a principal for Ryan. And Ryan, if you're not familiar with Ryan, is we are a global business tax and tax technology firm. I'm here today in support of 2959 because it does two very simple things. It protects taxpayer privacy, and it restores fairness to the property tax appeal process. Property owners appealing valuations must disclose detailed income information for income-producing properties, such as rent rolls, lease terms, operating expenses, and budgets. These documents are the operational blueprint of every business. Effectively, they're trade secrets. Imagine this. When you challenge the IRS, your full tax return is placed in the public file where anyone can access and view it. Without these protections, disclosure risks competitive harm, embarrassment, and discourages legitimate appeals. This current bill also addresses what's commonly referred to as the August 1st rule. The tax court has interpreted this statute as black and white. Over the years, they've also added additional and expanded this statute as well. Appeals are being dismissed without ever reaching the valuation merits. Cases have been lost over technical issues like a rent roll showing 11 units instead of 12 units, or omission of a temporary or verbal lease, which has no impact on the valuation. The court itself has described the penalty as, quote, extraordinary, end quote, and, quote, draconian, end quote. The court further states that the law, quote, leaves no doubt that the legislature intends a harsh remedy for noncompliance, and we have imposed that remedy when warranted, end quote. Procedural perfection has begun to outweigh fairness in property tax appeals. Further, the current penalty in Subdivision 6 is in direct conflict with Subdivision 1, which directs the tax court to, quote, disregard technicalities and matters of form not affecting the merits, end quote. Why this matters? An appeal should be resolved based on merit, not paperwork technicalities or minor omissions. Minnesota is an outlier. I've worked many states across the U.S., and Minnesota has become an outlier where harmless omissions will end a property tax appeal. This undermines the confidence in the fairness of our tax system. In closing, 2959 does not hide evidence or limit assessors. It protects confidential data. It ensures appeals are decided on the merits. Fair taxation should never require procedural dismissals as the price of due process. I respectfully ask for your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thor. Our next testifier on the list is Alex Smith. Once you get situated, could you please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, thank you. Hello, my name is Alex Smith. Thank you, Madam Chair, members, for having us here today. I am here today as a real estate professional with more than 19 years of experience in the commercial real estate industry. I've actively participated in numerous tax appeal processes here in Minnesota. I'm specifically here as I've personally been impacted by the challenges around data privacy as it relates to the tax appeal process. We are in strong support of the 2959 bill on behalf of the commercial real estate industry. We appreciate Chair Scott's work on this over the last several years. Without this bill, proprietary business data, including deal terms, rent roll, which is what a tenant pays, in addition to concessions, allowances negotiating during and paid during lease negotiation and lease deal making. This information can become public and accessible to our competitors during the tax appeal process. In a market that's extremely competitive, it's essential that each business maintain data privacy as it relates to deal terms and specific deal practices and proprietary information. Personally, I've witnessed ownership settle cases with less than ideal terms, specifically because of the concerns about data becoming public to competitors if they were to go to trial. Perhaps even more concerning, as Lane had indicated, as it is today, a property's data can be made public without their knowledge as a part of a different tax appeal process. This is because an assessor can use building information who have nothing to do with that specific appeal to establish values in court, thus publicly disclosing data, business data, without an owner's knowledge. Adopting this bill would ensure a fair and equitable process where assessors have the information that they need while also protecting non-public private information in a competitive market. In closing, I'd just like to say that the Minnesota commercial real estate industry is suffering. In downtown Minneapolis specifically, there's building values that have dropped more than 90%. It's critical for owners to be able to right-size their property valuations without losing their competitive edge. This would allow the competitive edge that would allow them to rebuild their value. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you, Chair Scott. I'm happy to help. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Next on the list is Rebecca Holshue. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Good morning. My name is Rebecca Holshue. Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I lead the county attorney's tax court practice, in which our team defends approximately 2,000 new cases each year. I am not privy to the motivations of this bill's proponents, but I can tell you the impact will be to benefit the owners of commercial real estate in litigation at the expense of other taxpayers. Let me explain why. This bill has three major consequences. It will weaken statutory protections for real estate data, it will result in less accurate property tax assessments, and it will prevent the government from defending its value in court. First, this bill does not strengthen privacy protections. In fact, it does the opposite. Right now, the data in question is classified as non-public under Section 13.51 of the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. This means the government cannot share it unless the requester obtains a court order. The court gets to decide whether the data is discoverable, and if so, whether its value to the litigant outweighs the privacy interest. That statute also requires notice to the property owner when sensitive data about that property is disclosed. This bill would eliminate both of these protections, allowing any tax court litigant to obtain non-public data about its competitors without notice to the property owner and without a court order. Second, this bill will increase the cost of tax court litigation and result in less accurate assessments. Right now, the data at issue is protected by the Data Practices Act, which assessing offices know how to apply uniformly. But this bill would require a unique protective order in every single case, which could result in potentially thousands of different orders with slightly different protections. Assessing offices are not equipped to isolate data points in this way, nor should they. The statutory mandate is to value property at market value, so assessors should look at market data. When data is collected by assessing offices, it may be entered into a spreadsheet or a model to develop a more accurate assessment. The point is not to view a property in isolation, as this bill would require, but to look at the market. If we lose the ability to compare the value of properties to one another, assessments will be less accurate and property taxes less fair. Third and finally, this bill will shift the tax burden to other property owners by making it harder for the government to defend the value of a particular property. This bill requires a protective order before a party can present any evidence to the court. If the government cannot comply with the protective order, which will almost certainly be the case, it will not be able to defend the assessment. The property owner will win a lower assessed value and a lower tax bill by default, which will of course shift the property tax burden to those taxpayers who have chosen not to challenge their assessments. In sum, what this bill really does is make it easier for litigants to gain access to sensitive information without showing a need for that information. It increases the cost of property tax litigation, and it makes it harder for the government to defend the value of an assessed property. Thank you very much for listening to my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Holshue, and I am almost certain that there'll be some questions for you as we move into member discussion. Next on the list is Patrick Chapman. And if you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, chairs, esteemed members. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today. I'm Pat Chapman. I'm the Ramsey County Assessor and also a member of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. The impact of this change would mostly be felt by institutional office and industrial building owners. It would almost have no benefit for the smaller businesses in the state of Minnesota. And the biggest negative impact would be felt by residential property owners, as surely there would be a shift of property tax from the large institutional owners to the smaller residential owners. The tax court process is already tilted in favor of the large petitioner, as the fee to file a tax court petition is $310. That fee can apply to a number of properties as long as you own them in the same jurisdiction. That fee does not even cover the cost to administer the file as it goes through Minnesota Tax Court or a county's office. Assessors have a long-standing history of securing private data. It only becomes available in the tax court process when someone says we're wrong. The assessors are very proud of securing this data and enjoy the opportunity to hold that data close. The fair and equitable value of a property is the cornerstone of the Minnesota property tax system. This bill undermines that system for the benefit of the people at the very top of the system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chapman. Is there any member of the public who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion on the bill. Does anyone have any questions for either Chair Scott or the testifiers? Representative Feist.
Hi. Sometimes I ask questions that make it really clear how little I understand things, so this is probably one of those. But is there any way that the data could be like disaggregated so that it's not identifying any specific businesses? It seems like the goal is to have some type of information equity through this process without sharing sensitive data that would, you know, undermine like fair competition between businesses. Is there any way that data could be presented in a way that isn't identifying specific businesses? And forgive me if this is the dumbest question ever.
Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, it's not a dumb question. And I would ask one of our testifiers to come and see if the practicality of that, it's a very good thought to disaggregated so that they wouldn't know whose data it was, but I'll let one of the testifiers with more experience.
Mr. Thorpe.
Co-chair, there is a way, but it's very expensive And with the changes to the statute, those protections automatically apply. And it does benefit small business owners because with the automatic protection, they don't have to litigate whether or not this data needs to be protected.
Mr. Chapman, did you have something to add?
Thank you, Chair, colleagues. The data could be protected in the appraisal process if we didn't have to name it during the court proceeding. You could protect that data there. It only comes out in that process when something is submitted to court. So we use market inputs. So a lot of times it's in spreadsheets, and we have this this piece of information that all of these properties have developed. So using those inputs, sometimes that data is exposed in court. So a possibility is making the work file confidential. But the burden of proof is on the petitioner to prove that, and then we have to defend. So we need this information. This is how value is is created, or you know, the opinion is developed, is through analyzing market inputs, and these market inputs are what we're using.
Representative Feist.
Thank you so much. To the extent that I understood that, maybe there is some way that we could look at the data before it becomes part of the court proceeding, and I don't know. I'm happy to, I feel like I really don't understand this, but I understand it's complicated and important and that there are differences of opinions. I do think that Section 5 seems reasonable. I just wanted to mention that. As an immigration attorney, there are so many aspects of my practice that there is no harmless error, like exception whatsoever, and it's terrifying. And so I think putting in harmless errors and allowing people to like correct the record seems very reasonable to me. But I'm happy to work with you on this. I think sometimes, like, it looks like it's bipartisan in the Senate, and or at least there's a DFL author in the Senate. So to the extent that we can get folks together and have a productive conversation, I'd be happy to work with you on it. Thanks.
I share your less than clear understanding of the things that are being discussed. Thank you, Representative Feist. I have a question for Mr. Chapman. You talk about market inputs. I served on a city council, dealt with people wanting to push back on their valuations. Can you just give us kind of like a 101, like you were talking to maybe eighth graders about how the assessment process works?
Certainly, Representative. So for a commercial property, we'll talk about a commercial high-end property. You derive the income that that property could produce. You develop the amount of expenses that are associated with that. Then you get the capitalization rate from rents and other properties to try to figure out how much income it takes to generate a value for that property. And then you put all of those things together to come up with a valuation. It's inside of the income approach. Rents and capitalization rates are the, in a rental situation, our income and capitalization rates are very, very important in trying to develop what an income or what a valuation is for a property.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chapman. Is there any other member discussion? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just have a question for the counties as well, which is, you know, the commercial business owners, commercial property owners are trying to solve what they see as an imbalance in this process. Do the counties think that there is a problem that needs to be solved? Or do you think there's not a problem and we're just trying to tilt it in favor?
Ms. Holshue.
Thank you very much, Representative. We believe this bill is a solution in search of a problem. Right now, the legislature has already afforded a better safeguard for this data, and that is Section 13.51 in the Data Practices Act. And what this bill would effectively do is undo that protection for anybody who chooses to file a tax court appeal. And they could have access to all of the information that would otherwise be protected. It is true, the government has a unique position, and I think that is certainly a source of concern in that the government is tasked with defending these cases in court, but also safeguarding the information it collects in order to perform its assessment function under the law. But that is the government's job. That is its statutory role to wear both of those hats. Right now, protected under 13.51, the court is required to employ the balancing test before releasing this private information. So what happens is a litigant, somebody challenging their property taxes, who wants access to the non-public data about other properties, has to go to the court and request a court order. And under 13.03, subdivision 6, the court has to do a balancing test and determine that this information is so important that it warrants compromising the privacy of the information through its disclosure. 13.51 also requires notice to the owner of the subject property. And so this legislation would eviscerate both of those privacy protections.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Finke. And I'll have the testifier here to my left, your right, just elaborate on this some more. But this is not a problem in search of a solution in search of a problem. The Supreme Court of Minnesota has said the legislature needs to weigh in on this, that it's that the law right now is rather ambiguous. That those were their words, not mine. And so I just want to go back to this thing of putting the assessors in at a disadvantage somehow in the courtroom. If they're party to the suit, then they have this, even if they put this if this becomes the law of the land, the protective order would allow anyone that's party to the suit to have access to that information. So they're going to have the same access to the information as the plaintiff would. But I will let the testifier elaborate.
Mr. Thor.
Yeah, I second everything that Madam Chair has stated. And, you know, the litigation process itself is very expensive. And without the automatic protection of this data, small businesses would have to spend a lot of money to get these protections. And so really this is a question of fairness. It's not about restricting access to data to certain parties. Both parties, as Madam Chair has stated, would still have access to this information. And both parties would have access to information outside of the case that is publicly available or through other subscription services. And so one example is that as a consultant to property owners all the time hire experts who don't have access to this information, and yet they're still able to produce a credible appraisal report for litigation purposes. And so I don't think this hampers either side. I think it just makes the playing field and rules more clear, and it makes it more fair for everybody.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Hudson. So we're talking past each other. You can't really compromise on a problem when one side thinks there's a problem and the other side doesn't. So just backing up what Rep. Feist has said, there is obviously some work that needs to get done, and I hope that you guys can figure out what we're really talking about.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. To the bill author, Chair Scott, we're in the Judiciary Committee. We're talking about data practices. This is what we do here in this committee. And from my perspective, you know, regardless of how folks sort of stand or feel on data privacy in this bill, who should have it, what should change, what the problem might be. I agree with Rep. Finke in that I think maybe some more collaboration, even behind the scenes, to really get to the root of what seems to be the problem and what the court was suggesting that we fix and get some clarity there. But I do want to talk about the impact that data privacy changes the impact that could happen down the road, like the impact on business owners, the impact on constituents. I don't have a question for you, but it's more so when we're talking about what kind of data is public, what kind of data is private, how does that then impact, for example, if it drastically shifts the appraisal value of a property, and of course then the business is paying less property taxes. Now we can have a whole other conversation about the fairness there, right, between what has been assessed and what is actually potentially, right? But the impact then, which was I think somebody briefly mentioned, was if a county then is counting on that assessment to be accurate, and then they lose tax revenue because the assessment lowers, where are they going to make up for that, right? And that's just, I think, a larger conversation that is related to this bill, not necessarily a judiciary part, but I just want to, as folks are talking about this, consider what the ultimate impact will be on revenue for counties and on the average taxpayer, because we certainly don't want that to be deferred or passed on then to residential property taxes.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Curran, for the question. And I'm having a hard time following the line of thinking that it's going to drastically do anything to assessed values that is going to be passed along to, say, residential homeowners, something like that. The assessors will have the access to the same exact data as the plaintiffs in these cases. So I just have a hard time following that line of thinking. And, you know, one thing that I would add is just from one of the justices, and I'm going to quote Justice Thiessen here, but he expressed concern that even allowing assessors to use third-party non-public data in their trial appraisal reports under the limited statutory exception relating to assessors' records was fundamentally inconsistent with the legislative purpose and intent of classifying the data as non-public and protecting it in the first place. He recommended the legislature fix the language to provide clarity in the future. So, and it wasn't just him that weighed in on this. Several of the justices made similar statements. And so I think that I would love to see both sides of this, both sides of this issue come together more and work on a solution. If this isn't the one, then the assessors need to come to the table and talk with the building owners, because the current system is not fair.
Good. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Chair Scott. I think this is a pretty productive conversation already. I appreciate what you have to offer in response to my comments and questions. And I think we're showing that we're doing our best to get some good work done. So I appreciate that.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Scott, thanks for bringing this. It takes a lot of something to take a bill like this and bring it, because it's complicated. And obviously, we're all lay people here with regard to this, and it's really, we're all kind of struggling to understand the ins and outs of this. And I know the issue's been kicking around for a while, but we haven't all been engaged on it like you have. So thanks for indulging us. And I've heard some great questions from my colleagues, too. So what I'm a little bit still struggling with is, so what exactly in the statute is unclear? You know, I've heard a couple times, well, the statute is, there's inconsistencies, and I'd really like to hear also from the testifiers, you know, so if you could tell me that, Chair Scott, and then, you know, and then your testifier maybe, if he agrees with you, and then I'd like to hear from the counties, you know. Because I think that seems to be the meat. There are two things I think are going on. One is whether it's unclear, and the other is whether it's fair. But let's first deal with the unclear part.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think there are two sections, 13.51 sub 2 and section 278.05 sub 3. And sub 6 on 1303 could come into play too. And the testifier may be able to elaborate more on the unclear versus the unfair, the distinction there.
Okay, but Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thanks. The numbers, you know.
I'm sorry.
That just doesn't compute for me. I'm sorry, and probably for anyone listening doesn't. If you could Like, tell me what the real issues are that are unclear in the statute.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe House Research could address the unclear versus the unfair, or sometimes the unclear delve into the unfair. But his summary is pretty helpful, I think.
Mr. Hopkins, do you have anything for us?
Mr. Chair and members, so one of the issues that the Minnesota Supreme Court has grappled with as this question has come to it over the years has been the relationship between the section of law that's amended in Section 4 of the bill on page 3, which says that assessor records shouldn't be excluded from discovery or admissible evidence on the grounds that the documents and the information recorded thereon are confidential or classified as private data on individuals. So the relationship between that provision in Chapter 278 and the general requirements under Chapter 13 that when a party in the litigation context seeks from a government entity data that is classified as not public, the government entity needs to deny that request and get from and ask the and the court a court needs to issue an order regarding that discovery request, in which the court uses the balancing test that's at Section 13.03 subdivision 6 of the Data Practices Act. So that's been the question before the court over the years. The Minnesota Supreme Court over the years has been, what's the relationship between the section amended in Section 4 of the bill and the balancing test for purposes of civil discovery that's in Chapter 13. So those are the things that the courts have tried to reconcile in the past, but I can't really speak to the issue of unfairness.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. That is helpful. Yeah, I don't really need you to go to the unfairness part. I think we've been kind of hearing that. So I guess what I would just say is that, as you can see, like for the folks who are testifying, who I'm sure know this, and for the public, this isn't always the best forum to resolve complicated technical disputes, right? Notwithstanding that the courts want us to clarify, it's really hard. We're not experts on this. And so it kind of, again, I think some of my colleagues said this, kind of puts it back in the court of the parties to try to, you know, the people who have expertise in this, to try to see if there can be some accommodation. I think we heard a good suggestion here, one way you might go, from Representative Feist. Maybe there's a way to make that process of having the data be, what was the term you used, you know, the generic data, to have it collective data.
Disaggregated.
Yeah, aggregated data. You know, maybe there's a way to do that more cheaply and easily. Maybe there is, and if somebody tries to do that. So, but I mean, I think it's pretty clear that some of us are not comfortable today, and thank you for just deciding to lay the bill over at the outset. You know, this is, it seems like there's a lot at stake, and we don't have a comfort level to be able to say this is the solution. And certainly with the counties here saying that we don't even have a problem, it's difficult for us to put our thumb on the scale here. So Thank you for bringing the discussion, Chair Scott.
I see no further member discussion requests, so Chair Scott, if you want to respond to Chair Liebling and wrap that into your closing remarks, we can move forward.
Members, thanks for a good discussion on this. I really wish the bill could move forward, and hopefully a message has been sent to both sides to work together to come up with a solution on this. The problem's not going away, I just want to, I'll just go through some of my closing statements here. Taxpayers should not be required to surrender their privacy rights to exercise their legal right to challenge a tax assessment. As stated in the letter that you found online from Mr. Thor, such exposure of sensitive and confidential business information is harmful and unfair and should remain protected in court. And finally, in Section 5, I don't think there's probably dispute on this piece, that it's more than reasonable to allow a 30-day period to provide any missing information on these challenges, to allow the owners to get that missing data. As Mr. Thor said, just because you got it wrong and it was an 11-unit building, not a 12-unit building, there was one minor technical thing, your case should not be dismissed. So with that, members, thank you again for a good discussion, and I look forward to future discussions on this and hopefully a solution.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Seeing no further discussion, the bill will be laid over. The next meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee will be on Tuesday, March 3rd, and Chair Liebling will have the gavel. The meeting is adjourned.